Now we're holding on Peches Amadei's, the last line. We learned yesterday, now that we're talking about the mitzvah of Kisi Adam, that you have to cover the blood with dirt. So we learned yesterday that because Avraham Avinu had said, "Vanuchi Ofer Ve'Efer, I am dust and ashes," therefore his descendants were zeicha to these two mitzvahs, Efer Parah V'Afar Sarcha. We have the ashes of the Parah Aduma, and we have the dust of the Sarcha, which, as we talked about yesterday, Marsha points out, not to say that the mitzvah might not have existed at all without that, but without Avraham saying, "Vanuchi Ofer Ve'Efer," and showing that tremendous humility, as the Gemara is going to talk about soon, then the Chachamim, then Hashem might have made it. That, for example, you need something very hard to obtain in order to become tahor from Tumas Nes, or to be tahor of a soita to her husband, and Hashem instead of, because Avraham talked this way, then therefore Hashem gave the Jewish people like a very easy way, relatively speaking, to accomplish these things. So now, and then we said, what about Kisi Adam? We said, because there you don't really have a Hanah from it. We want to focus on mitzvahs where there's a Hanah from it. With Parah Aduma, you have a Hanah, you're now Torah from Tumas Nes, and you're able to enter the Bais HaMikdash, and you're able to eat Kodshim. And with Afar Soita, there's a direct Hanah that now she's mutter to her husband again, as opposed to Kisi Adam. There's a mitzvah in it, but without the Kisi, you'd also be able to eat the meat as well. So therefore, so it's not really counted as much. So the Gemara continues, of Omar Rava, and the spus of Avraham saying that I'm not going to take from the spoils of Sodom, even from a thread to a shoestring. So this is, you have the four kings that fought against Sodom, and they captured everything, all the people and all the wealth over there. Avraham set out and defeated the four kings and brought back Lot and all the other captives and all the wealth and everything. And then the king of Sodom offers him 10 million nefesh. He says, give me the lives, and you can keep the wealth for yourself. And Avraham tells him, no, I'm not taking any of the spoils. I'm not taking even a thread or even a shoe strap. So the Rebbe, by the way, points out in a letter, interestingly, that threads or strings, means a thread or a string, are sometimes used as headbands or head decorations, as we find in the Gemara in Shabbos, to that effect. So therefore, Michut Bad Surech Nal is literally from head to toe. Anyway, so because Avraham refused to take even the slightest trace of Gezel, now it's not Gezel really per se, it belongs to him legally, but in other words, it's something that after all is not his, but he was machmer on himself. So Zachobon of the Shtei Mitzvahs. For that, his children were Zeicha to two mitzvahs, Lachot Shal Tcheles of a Tzur Shal Tfilin, were Zeicha to the Tcheles string in Tzitzis, and the straps of it corresponding to the foot, and the straps of Tfilin corresponding to the Tzurich Nahal. So in other words, again, the idea being that without that there still would have been a mitzvah of tzitzis and of tefillin, but without that, Maharsho explains, there might not have been a string of tchelas in the tzitzis. They could just be plain white strings, as we have nowadays, because we don't know for sure what tchelas is. And as far as tefillin also, they didn't have to be held on with straps. You can hold them on with something else. But in the source of Avraham saying like that, then his descendants are zeicha to these two details of these mitzvahs. So mostly the Shlemer of Tzur Shal Tefillin. Well, I can understand, there is, by the way, some interesting connections between Tzurich Nal, a shoelace, and a shoe strap, whatever, and Tefillin, that the Gemara is saying in the video, that one is a schus for the other. There are places actually in Sifrei Kabbalah where it talks about the deeper connection between shoes and tefillin, aside from the fact that they're both made out of leather, of course. But you also have the famous story Sam Sapozhnik, where Yid goes to a goy to ransom. There had been a pogrom. The goyim had looted Jewish property, so now Yid goes over there to try to ransom Tashmishik Dusha, and he finds he sees over there a pair of tefillin, and he says to the guy, how much? The guy quotes him a price. The kid says, that's way much. What are you thinking to charge such amount for stolen goods? And the guy, you know, doesn't know what tefillin are. He never saw them before. As far as he knows, they're leather cases with straps. As far as he's concerned, they're shoes. So he says, like, I'm very injured innocence. What do you mean? Sam Sapozhnik, I myself, I'm a shoemaker. I made these, which, of course, he didn't. And then they never brought that all in a lot of times as a mushal, and a mushal and a nimshal, with the idea being that realize what you know and what you don't know, and have a sense of bittul, and then to realize what you don't know, and not to think you can just do everything yourself. Anyway, so they were in that story. You actually see where the guy thinks that tefillin are shoes. Anyway, so he was saying that Taka in the schus of Avraham speaking like that about the shoelaces, then his children or his descendants are zeicha to the straps of tefillin. Well, again, we have to be talking about something where there's a hanah from it. So the Gemara asks, "Shlemer at source of tefillin, the fact that we have straps of tefillin, and particularly that we have, that therefore we can strap them on our heads, then we know there's a benefit from that." The pasuk says, "V'ro chal amei ha'aretz ki shem Hashem nikra alecha, all the nations of the earth will see that the name of Hashem is called on you." And then, as the pasuk says, they will fear you. The Tanya and the Luna Brayser, the Yezar, God Olayma, Eved Tefillin Shabarosh. That this refers particularly to Tefillin on the head, which has most of the letters of the name Shin Dalad Yud in it. You have the Shins on the two sides of the Bayis and the Shalosh, and you have the Dalad and the Knot. So when the Goyim see that on a Yid's head, they're afraid, as we have many stories. We have many different stories of that. So we can see, in other words, there's a direct benefit to the straps of the Tefillin. Without the strap, you wouldn't have that Dalad Knot. And without strap, you wouldn't have the tefillin, wouldn't be on your head. Elachut shot tchelas ma'ihi, but where do we see what's the great advantage of the string of tchelas, of the thread of tchelas in sixes? And the answer is the Tanya, the Meir Omer, as we learn in the Braisa, the Meir explains, we learned this in Menachos a few months ago. Manishtana tchelas mikolot tzivonin, why is tchelas unique among all the other dyes that the Torah says after that you should use for tzitzis? The reason is because tchelas, the color of tchelas resembles the color of the sea. In fact, the Gemara in Menachos, we learned in Menachos that in fact the creature it comes from also resembles the sea in color. The yam domel rakia, and in turn the sea resembles the heavens in color. The rakia domel even sapphire, and the heavens resemble sapphire. The even sapphire domel kisei covered, and in turn that resembles the kisei covered. And we see the connection between those last two, that the kisei hakavod is compared to sapphire. As it says in the pasuk by Matan Torah, by Yiru Asel Kei Yisrael, they saw a vision of the glory of Hashem. Literally, it says they saw Hashem, but you can't see Hashem himself. It means they saw the Shechina, the Sachas Raglov of Gemara, under his feet, so to speak, they saw a brickwork of sapphire. Rashi explains on the pasuk there was brickwork there in the sense that during the time when the Jewish people were enslaved in Mitzrayim and they were working with bricks, and Hashem Imo Yenech Mitzara, Hashem, so to speak, also had brick making equipment there in Shemayim, and now it was Ketzim Hashemayim Latoha, like the very purity of heaven. So we see, in other words, that so Rashi explains that when it says Masi Libnas Asapro Ketzim Hashemayim, then we can understand from that the very heavens are like the color of sapphire, and in turn the sapphire itself, a fear, and Yechezkel's vision of the Merkava, he describes the Kisei covered itself to Mare Evan Sapir Gmus Kisei. He says, I saw a semblance of a throne looking like sapphire stone. So we see that sapphire resembles the color of the Kisei covered. So therefore, in other words, the idea is, Rashi explains, when Hashem, so to speak, looks at his Kisei HaKavod, then he remembers this mitzvah, which is equivalent to all the other mitzvahs, and that benefits the Jewish people, that Hashem is reminded of our Schosim. In a different place, Rashi gives a different way of looking at it, that it's also the person himself, when he sees the tzitzis, then he remembers that resembles the sea, which in turn reminds him of Kriyas Yamsuf, and in turn that makes him focus on Hashem, and that benefits him. Anytime a Yid focuses on Hashem, then it does good for him. There's different actually. Rashi elsewhere points out, why don't we just say straight that the tchelos is like the kisei covered? Why do we have to go through all these intermediate steps? And Rashi explains in Sota, this Gemara is also in Sota, that it's not exactly, the tchelos is like the sea, but it's not exactly like sapphire. The sea is like the heavens, but not exactly. So each one is closer and closer to the shade, and eventually you reach the shade of the kisei covered. And again, it evokes or spoken by Hashem, and vice versa, it evokes that a Yid thinks of Kriyas Yamsuf and thinks of Hashem. So that's the advantage of the tchelos and tzitzis, is that that evokes all of that, and therefore that's considered a hanah, and therefore, and again, we were zeichah to that because of Avraham saying that he wouldn't take michut v'ad zeichah. And Gemara goes on, speaking of this pasuk where, so Avraham is saying that I won't take any chutvad sivish now, but you know, I won't take even a trace of the spoils of Sodom. But then he goes on to say, Bil Odai, it's outside of me, meaning I'm nothing to do with it. But he says, Rakasha Ochlana Orim, only however there's what the young men ate, meaning the men that Avraham had with him in his pursuit of the four kings and his defeat of them. So they ate, they used up some of the spoils. So, and Avraham is implying that he's not going to return that. He's not going to reimburse the people of Sodom for that. So the Gemara points out, Amar Rabba, Kosh Gezel HaMechol, see how hard it is to do tshuva for something that was stolen, which then was consumed. Even tzaddikim gemurim like Avraham are not able to return it. Shenemar, as we see that Avraham says, Bil Odai, aside from Rakasha Ochlan Orim, what the young men ate. In other words, Avraham is saying, I'm not going to take anything from the spoils of Sodom because it doesn't belong to me, and I don't want to have benefit from mice and nissim and so on and so forth. But there's already what was eaten and what was eaten already, and now I'm not going to pay for that. Now, of course, there's the point that Marsha points out. I mean, listen, the whole thing wasn't Gezel in the first place. Avraham was 100% entitled to it because he had won it, and he had won it in battle. So it's not like it's real Gezel, but in other words, the point is, whenever you talk about, but you see, in other words, when there is real, but you see another person who's not a tzaddik gomer, and here you have, it wasn't even real Gezel, and still Avraham finds it difficult to return. And he says, you know what, what's done is done. What they ate already, and I'm not going to reimburse it. How much more so a regular person, and how much more so when it really is Gezel? So in other words, there's the idea, you know, you have halachas about if a person steals something and then he eats it or he feeds it to his children or whatever, when it has to be reimbursed and when not. But you see, says Rav Abba over here, how difficult it is to do that. In fact, you have a story in the Gemara in Bava Kamma where there was a guy who had lived much of his life off Gezel, and eventually he wants to do tshuva and start returning what he stole to the various owners. And his wife tells him, you know what, you realize that, you're going to be left with nothing. Even the clothes on your back come from Gezel. And then he said, you know what, then you're right, I can't be, then in that case, I give up, I can't do tshuva. All right, the Gemara goes on. Talking about this, that Avraham said, V'anoichi ofer ve'efram, dust and ashes, that he showed a tremendous amount of humility. So let's talk a little bit about that. Amar Rav Yechonim, Mishum Rav Elazar ben Rav Shimon, first of all, you should know, whenever you come across a teaching of Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Yisak Levi, in Agadah, it's something well worth listening to. Make your ears like a funnel, in other words, make your ears wide open to hear everything he has to say. He's going to teach you something very, very important. Rabbi Eliezer, the notion of Yosef Gili, had explained as follows. A pasuk at the end of last week's parasha, it's not because you're the largest, or it's not because you're biggest of the nations that Hashem desired you, etc. And the pasuk continues, you're the least of all the nations. Now, in the simple sense, it means exactly that the Jewish people are the smallest of all nations. But first of all, then there's no need for the pasuk to spell that out. And second of all, why would we think Hashem loves the Jewish people just because we're numerically larger? So it means, Rabbi Eliezer had explained, Omalahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael Cheshkani Bachem. So Hashem said to the Jewish people, you know why I love you? You know why I desire you? Choshek Hashem Bachem. Because Loi Me Rubchem Widaushim, not because of your greatness, meaning you don't make yourselves proud. But rather, kiyatam ma'at, you make yourselves humble. Even when I bestow goodness on you, you make yourself small and humble before me. And Hashem says, I appreciate that, as we find in many places, that Gaiva counteracts Hashem's presence in the world, and Hashem likes to be together with the humble. So the reason I love you, Hashem says to the Jewish people, is because you have that sense of bittul and that sense of being a makabel to Hashem. So, as we have these, as we have many examples, Nasati Gdula Avraham, for example, I gave greatness, wealth, and fame, and everything else to Avraham. Omalafana, and how does Avraham respond? Vanoshi off of Afer. He says, I'm dust and ashes, which in particular, as we learned yesterday, the Alta Rebbe explains in Tanya, means that Avraham is saying, as much as I've, never mind the Gashmistic, my Gashmistic accomplishments, even the Ruchnius, Avraham was the very personification of the Midah, of Hashem's Midah of Chesed, and nevertheless, Hashem, and nevertheless, Avraham says, compared to the actual Midah of Chesed of Hashem's, I'm like dust and ashes that come from a burnt log compared to the log itself. So Avraham shows tremendous anivus in saying that and in not taking any credit for himself of everything that he had accomplished. Similarly, Hashem continues, Moshe v'Aaron, I gave greatness to Moshe and Aaron, the leaders of the Jewish people. Omar, and he said, or they said, Omru, actually they said, v'nachnu ma, and they said, and what are we? But David, Hashem says, I gave greatness to David. Omar, and David's response is, v'anochi selas v'lo ish, I am a worm, not a man. So each one of them expressed in a different way his sense of bittul before the greatness of Hashem. So as great as they are, they recognize that Hashem is infinitely greater than them, and they felt that humility. And with Avraham, with David HaMelech in particular, the Maharsha points out, the Medrash tells us that David was destined to live only 3 hours, and then other magicians saw that, it was shown that by Hashem, and he says a special neshama like that can't just be in the world for 3 hours, and he gave him 70 years of his lifetime. The Zohar says that the Ovos and Yosef also gave him years anyway. So the idea is that David is saying, if it hadn't been for that, literally I would have been worms, I would have been worm food, having died as a newborn baby after 3 hours, and I never would have become an ish, I never would have become a man. So each of them, Hashem is saying, as these examples, they, despite their tremendous accomplishments, the Gashmias and the Ruchnias, they were all humble and they all knew to give the credit to Hashem. On the other hand, but Rebbe Eliezer continues, when it comes to the Goyim, it's not so. When they get greatness from Hashem, that makes them proud. For example, Nasati Gdulu the Nimrod, I gave greatness to Nimrod. He was the king, as Rashi points out, at the time of the Dura Flogger. And what did he do with that greatness? He was the first world ruler. Omar, he says, Hovon Nivnalanu Iu, come, let's build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in heaven. And in fact, as the Gemara tells us elsewhere, his poem is called Nimrod because Himrod is full of Olam. He caused the entire world to rebel against Hashem. The Tower of Babel was in various ways an attempt to rebel against Hashem. They'll all live in one place rather than populating the whole earth as Hashem wants them to. They're going to go up to the tower and fight against Hashem from there. They're going to claim that the Babel was a natural event and therefore they need towers to hold up the sky, etc., etc. Rabbi Yonasan Eidenschitz has an interesting explanation. I mean, he says the Tower of Babel was actually a spaceship. They literally wanted to take a spaceship and go up to heaven and fight against Hashem there. So that's Nimrod with all of his great. And he has the entire world under his thumb, then this is what he does with it, is to rebel against Hashem and cause everybody else to go the same way. L'paroi, Hashem says, I gave greatness to Paroi. Omar, and what does he say? Mi Hashem, who is Hashem that I should have to listen to him? Sancheirev, I gave greatness to Sancheirev. He was also a world, he was the leader of the world power at that time of Asher. Omar, and what did he say when he's besieging Yerushalayim? Mi b'chol olekehar ratzis v'gemu, who is there among all the gods of the nations that save their countries, and I'm greater than all of them, and he claimed to be even greater than Hashem. So in Chassidus, it talks about, Paray at least recognized that there's a concept of Hashem. He just said, why should I have to listen to him? Sancheirev goes even further. Sancheirev is like the world's first atheist. He says that the whole concept of Hashem or Lahavdil of any other gods doesn't even exist. I myself am the supreme, power. Nebuchadnezzar, Hashem says, I gave power to Nebuchadnezzar. Omar, and he says, Ela Abomaseov, he says, I will go up onto above the heights of the clouds and make myself similar to Hashem. So he thought that he could make himself equal, that he could put himself on an equal level with Hashem. And L'chiram Melech Tzur, another example, Hashem says, I gave greatness to L'chiram Melech Tzur. Tzur in those times was a world capital of commerce and of commerce, and it was a very fabulously rich city. And what does Chiram do with it? He says, Moshe v'lekim yashavtu b'lev yamim. I've sat in the seat of Hashem in the midst of the seas. The Yalkut Shimoni goes and gives a whole long detailed description of a palace that Chiram built himself, built on pillars, literally in the middle of the sea. Sir, at the time was an island. So offshore of that island, he built himself this tremendous soaring palace that was meant to wherever the various parts of it are meant to represent the seven heavens and Gan Eden and so on and so forth. And he's sitting over there all within that, like, as though he himself is a god. And Hashem sends the Novi Yechezkel to tell him, "You're no such thing. You ain't no god. You're just a mortal, and you're gonna end up being defeated and killed." As in fact he was. So we see, in other words, Hashem says, is paraphrasing what Hashem in the Braisa. What Hashem is saying, that when I give greatness to the Jewish to the Jewish people, they use it properly. They have a sense of bittul. Meanwhile, when I give greatness to the goyim, then they misuse it and think of themselves as gods, or even beyond gods, or whatever. So therefore, lo merubcham mikol amim, not because you're not the reason Hashem loves you is because you don't make yourself greater and higher like the other nations. Instead, ki atam ha'ma'at mikol amim, among all the other nations, you're the ones who make yourself small and humble. And you credit the greatness to Hashem. More on this topic of the various expressions of humility that these different people said in Jewish history, Avraham versus Moshe and Aaron in particular. Omar Rava v'itemer Rav Yechanan, Rava says, or some say Rav Yechanan said, Godol shenema Moshe v'Aaron, Yosef v'mashenem of Avraham. What it says about Moshe and Aaron, the expression that they used on themselves to represent their bittul, is even greater than what it says about Avraham. The Ilu v'Avraham k'siv v'anoshi ofer v'efer. By Avraham, he says, I'm dust and ashes. Now, dust and ashes are a very lowly thing, but nevertheless, they're still a metzius. They still are. They're a substance. Whereas by Moshe and Aaron, says, what are we that they don't consider themselves as anything, not even as having any kind of substance? In other words, within Bittul itself, there's different degrees of Bittul. Avraham considered himself, he's on a high level of Bittul to Hashem. He's like a Merkava. He won't do anything without Hashem guiding him, like a chariot that won't go anywhere without its rider telling it, without its rider directing it. But nevertheless, Avraham still had a certain sense of a certain limited sense of self, whereas Moshe and Aaron went beyond that, and they have none at all, which is why we have that goes together with the fact that Moshe was the greatest of all the Nevi'im. He had the most unfiltered experience of Hashem because he had the greatest degree of bittul. There's many places in Siddur where it talks about that Moshe and Aaron, that Moshe in particular represents das, represents something within the intellectual sphere, as opposed to Avraham is within the midos, and then Moshe are higher than midos and higher and closer and closer to Bittul, and in fact Ma itself represents Chochma. So Moshe and Aaron in that sense are on a greater level, and their degree of bittul is an even greater one, and is an even greater one than that of Avraham Avinu. So again, in other words, you know, there are, you know, people are different great tzaddikim are going to have different degrees of bittul, but Moshe and Aaron reached the highest one possible compared even to the office. The Maharal explains basically, he talks about it in terms of what he calls an idea called pshitus, like the greater simplicity. Hashem is, in a sense, the ultimate simplicity, in that Hashem is yochid u'miyochad. Hashem is the one uniqueness in the world, where Hashem's oneness is, as we know, not any kind of composite oneness like any other being, but rather a simple oneness. So the closer one gets to that, then the closer one is to Hashem, and therefore, so now, Avraham is saying, v'anoshi ofer v'efer, which is the first cause of everything in the world, as the pasuk says, a kol hayom min ha'ofer, everything comes from the dust. But Moshe and Aaron go even beyond that, and they reach an even greater degree of pshitus, and therefore a greater degree of closeness to Hashem. So the Gemara continues, the whole world continues to exist only for the schus of Moshe and Aaron, and for people like them who have that ultimate degree of bittul to Hashem. And we know that. Here the Pasuk says that they're saying on themselves, what are we? And the Pasuk elsewhere says, hangs the earth on blima. So blima meaning nothingness, but blima is a composite word, bli, not, ma, anything. So those who say, we aren't anything, nachnu ma, what are we? Then they're the ones, tola eretz, Hashem hangs the world and makes the whole world depend on their existence. Omer Rav Ila, and Rav Ila says in this connection, another way of dashing in that pasuk, Eina ola miskayim ela b'shvil mishum for the miskatsim and b'shas meriva. The world continues to exist only in this, only because of someone who closes his mouth at a time of argument. So Rashi points out the word berlin means to close. In modern Hebrew, they use it to mean like breaking a car or something, like you're arresting, you're stopping its movement. So Bolam Askid means like he arrests and stops his mouth from talking in an argument. So somebody makes fun of him or somebody whatever, and he doesn't respond back. Finema, the same puzzle. Tola Eretz al Blima, Hashem hangs the earth on Blima. So here we're taking Blima as related to the as the word Blima, without anything. Meaning again, Moshe and Aaron, who consider themselves that we ourselves are not worthy of anything. That we realize that all the credit goes to Hashem. But here now we're taking Blima as one single word from the Shodesh Bolam, which means to close up. So the world stands on such a person. Yeah. Rabbi Bohu, Omar Rabbi Bohu says, not only that, it's not enough blima, misha makes him asmik, misha eno. It has to be that the person makes himself as though he's non-existent, has that even greater degree of bitter. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, umitachas zroyes olam, and from underneath are the arms of the world. Now, one meaning of that is that the Gemara in Chagiga explains that the world, so to speak, it is standing on the arm, on the power of Hashem. Rashi on the Pasuk points out in the Pasuk to sense, it means that Hashem is above and below him on earth, the various mighty people and mighty forces on earth. But now Rabbi Boho is taking it omitachas, and from underneath, somebody who makes himself like he's underneath, like anybody else, like he's available for others to step on him, to step over him. Zoyes olam, he is the arms that hold up the world. So now, you know, of course, it has to be not, can't be a false, can't be a false omnivorous, and it can't be the kind of thing where, you know, we have examples of it in Hasidic stories from the times of Baal Shem Tov, for example, of people who pretended to be great anovim, and they're doing it only that people should admire their omnivorous. We're not talking about that. We're talking about somebody who truly feels himself to be an anov and truly feels like anybody that, as a famous explanation of Hasidus. It's not that Moshe and Aaron, for example, didn't know of their capabilities. They knew them, but they knew that somebody else, that in particular Moshe, knew that somebody else with the same capabilities and the same advantages and whatever as him might have been able to accomplish even more. So that's true on Nivus. So Rav Ila had said that it's enough that a person holds himself back at a time of argument. Meaning, Ben Yehoyada says, so even he is actually insulted, he is highly insulted by what the other person says, but he holds himself back and doesn't respond, then that's a tremendous thing and the world stands because of him. Rav Bohu says that's not really enough. It has to be that he actually feels that he actually feels that he truly is nothing, and that they've and maybe even he deserves even bigger insults, and then the world stands on such a person. And the Maharal gives an explanation that basically, you know, the world stands firm in its and stays in its orbit and doesn't fall out of its orbit and doesn't get decentered from where it's supposed to be. So what does that stand on? Somebody who keeps his own equanimity, somebody who keeps himself centered and doesn't respond back angrily when somebody else insults him and doesn't even consider himself and doesn't consider himself to be important enough to not have to undergo this. So he keeps his sense of being centered where he's supposed to be and not going off to one direction or the other improperly. So because of that, Hashem pauses, because of him the world also stays centered and stays stable in its orbit. There's a well-known thing that says, started actually, that when a person is insulted, if he doesn't answer back, he has tremendous schusim to the point where he can daven on somebody else's behalf, and Hashem will unquestionably answer his tefillah. There's a well-known story with that, with a couple who were childless for many years. And they were told this idea. So one time they're at a simcha where somebody is having insults and all kinds hurled at them, and they plead with that person, don't answer back. And afterwards, after it's all over, they say, now please give us a bracha because you didn't answer back, and then therefore you have tremendous tefillin and shemayim. This person gave them a bracha, and the next year, sure enough, they had a baby. The Gemara continues, Amra Mitzvah, my dichtiv, what does it mean? Here's another thing about this, about staying silent at the appropriate time. The Pasuk says in Tehillim, Ha'unam Eilam Tzedek Tidaberun, Meshonim Tishpidu Bnei Odom. So the symbol meaning is something like, could it be that you mute when you're supposed to be speaking righteousness? You're supposed to be judging people fairly. It refers to, for example, the people of David HaMelech's times where they're hearing people making fun of David and questioning his yichus and everything, and David is telling them, how can you be silent like that? You're supposed to be speaking up and on behalf of justice and judging people fairly and so forth. So now the Gemara Darshan is as follows. The word ha'umnam, which means could it be, we're taking as maloshan umnos, which means a trade or a craft, a skill. What is the skill that a person has to develop in this world? It's Elam is shiyosam asmi ki ilam, that a person has to know when to make himself be silent. So umnam elam, the proper umnus, the proper skill to develop is elam. And in fact, it's called an umnus. It's not something that comes that easily. You know, a person could just be fine. I'll be a hermit. I won't talk to anybody. That's not the way. It's brought in the name of the Chofetz Chaim. That no, the idea is you have to know. You know, you have to train yourself. You have to develop that skill of when to talk and when not to talk. It's said actually about the Chofetz Chaim himself that the Chofetz Chaim wrote the book on Lashon Hara, and unfortunately a rather large fraction of things that people that many common people talk about often have a degree of Lashon Hara to them. So people say, though, you know, you would think then the Chofetz Chaim was probably not a very good conversationalist. He's probably always, whenever people are talking, he's probably always shushing them and telling them this is Lashon Hara. But in fact, not so. They say he was actually a very good conversationalist. He just knew how to talk about the right things and not to allow a trace of Lashon Hara to intrude. So that's umanusa shel adam yosem asnif dehilah. It's literally that skill of a person making himself mute at the appropriate times and knowing, on the other hand, when to not be. Now, continues the Braisa, Yochel Achla Divrei Torah. You would think that maybe it means the Elam, that he should also be silent and not even be speaking words of Torah. No, Talmud Lema, Tzedek Tidaberun. Therefore, the pasuk continues, you have to speak righteousness. Righteousness meaning Divrei Torah. Yochel Yogis Daitoi. Now, then you would think in that case, a person can be proud of his accomplishments in Torah. Talmud Lema, therefore, the pasuk finishes off, Meshorim Tish Peduvene Adam, in straightness, Meshorim literally means like flat lands, you should judge people. So in other words, flat lands are very easy for people to walk on, so therefore, a person needs to consider himself like the flat lands, which can easily be stepped on, and therefore, in the sense that he has to have that feeling of anivus, that we said before, where he's like the ground, the nafshitah alakotia, that he's receptive to what other people have to say and to do and to contribute, and he's just like the ground that they can step on and hold them up. Marshall gives a different explanation. You have a story of that Meshurim Tishpudu B'nei Adam. You have a story in the Gemara in Tainus where Rabbi Elazar ben Reb Shimon is coming back from the yeshiva, feeling very good about his accomplishments over there, and he meets up with an ugly guy, and he tells him, look how ugly you are, all the people in your town as ugly as you, and the guy says, I'll go complain to the craftsman, Hashem, who made me, and Rabbi Elazar ben Reb Shimon, Rabbi Elazar realizes he had spoken wrongly, and he begs the guy Mechila, and then they have a whole story over there, the upshot being that the guy says, I'm loyal, as long as he doesn't do this very awful. So now, in other words, may shorim teach for the adam. You have to be judging people. May shorim in a straight way, like kafskos, rather than you became a talmid chacham, and now therefore you're going to look down and condescend on them. This is sticha actually, where the Rebbe explains. I mean, there's more to the story than meets the eye. Or the laws of Rebbe Shimon is not just going to look at the superficial fact that the guy is ugly and put him down for that. And yeah, the Rebbe has a whole explanation, the gist of which is that Rebbe Elazar perceived that the guy is an ugly, not only begashmius but also beruchnius. He's like, he's not even glius ba'alma. He doesn't even seem to have the advantage that he's visibly a creature of Hashem, and therefore the Rebbe Elazar has to like give him shock treatment to tell him Do you realize how ugly and lowly you are? But then when the guy responds right away and says, go to the craftsman who made me, then Rebbe Elazar realizes, you know what, the guy does have an awareness of Hashem. I didn't have to use the stock method to talk to him like that, and therefore he's sorry and begs him the chila and so forth, and the guy says, fine, just in the end, don't do that. don't be accustomed to doing that. I mean, there's a place for that kind of thing. Sometimes you tack a fine such a person, but this wasn't the place. So that's always, again, the point of our show. This is Meshonim Tishpu B'nei Adam, is you have to be careful to judge people in that way. L'kafsos, even though you've learned Torah. There are places in the Chassidus where it talks about the explanation of this is that there are three stages in Bittul. When it comes to a person's Bittul to Hashem, when a person is becoming a Makabal of Torah. You have the first stage where he just has to have that Bittul and not have any agenda or anything of his own. He's just open to hear whatever Hashem has to tell him. So that's the Elam. He has to be silent and just listen. Then there comes the point. He himself eventually reaches the point of being there. He's learnt Torah, and now he has to be Mashpia. So now you would think that maybe he should still retain that first thing where he's just being quiet and listening. No, it's time for him to set it to that day, and it's time for him to say forth the righteousness and the goodness of Torah, of the Torah that he absorbed. But now, even after that, though, then. He has to stop being just a Makabal and become a Mashpia as well, and bring the light of Torah into the world. But now, even after that, he still has to be careful to retain that katnus, to retain that sense of smallness and humility and vittel, and therefore that's what it says, that Yocho Yogis Zaita, you would think maybe at this point, he has to abandon the mentality of Makabal altogether, and no, he still has to remain a Makabal even as he's being a Mashpia as well. Getting back now, so this was the whole piece of Agadta, again, which we got into by way of Avraham saying, Avon Noshi Offer Be'efer, and talking therefore about Afar Kisi Adam and so forth. Now getting back to Dinim of Kisi Adam. The Gemara says, Omer of Ze'era, the Tamer Rabba Bayumia, Machasin Ba'afar Irani Damas. You would be allowed to do Kisi Adam with dust from an Irani Dachas. We know that an Irani Dachas, the people there, or most of the people there, have worshipped Avodah Zarah, and all of them have to be executed, all the guilty parties have to be executed by beheading, and the city itself and all of the property in it has to be burnt. So now, Reb Ze'ero, Rabbi Yemiya is saying, nonetheless, you can use the dust from there, which at this point, the Gemara assumes that it means the ashes of it, of an irani dachas, as we learned yesterday, according to this hill, and this is the halacha, you're allowed to use ashes for kisi adam. Very well then, Reb Ze'ero, Rabbi Bar Yirmiyah says, you're allowed to use even the ashes of an irani dachas for that. So the Gemara asks, why? Ba'amai, Surah Hanoh, why isn't those, aren't those ashes also ba'anah? Mephoshim point out a question that, wait a minute, well, why is that? You have a general rule. There are certain kinds, we'll learn in the Masechta Temura next year, Bez Hashem, that there are certain kinds of Isurei Hanah that have to be burnt, and the ones that have to be burnt, you're allowed to have Hanah afterwards from the ashes, as opposed to there are other things which have to be buried, and those are in fact also Hanah even after they're burnt. Now, an Irani Dachas has to be burnt. So what's the problem? What's the problem? Why you would think you couldn't use the ashes? So Tosfos in that Gemara and Tmura explained that since by an Irani Dachas it says, V'lo yidbak b'yod chom umim and acherim, not even a trace of the banned object, of the banned stuff should remain in your hands, then therefore that means an Irani Dachas is indeed an exception to that, and you should not be able to use the ashes of an Irani Dachas either. Nevertheless, Reb Ze'ero, Rabbi Ubeyemi is saying that when it comes to kit, you can't use it for other purposes, but you can use it for kisi adam. So the Gemara asks, "Amai Isurei Hanahu? Why isn't it also Hanah?" And the answer is, "Amaz Ziri." So Ziri explains, "When Nitzuch El Afar Afara, we don't mean actually the ashes of it. What Reb Ze'ero, Rabbi Bar Yirmi, is talking about is the dirt of the Irani Dachas. So the actual dirt of the ground over there of what was formerly the Irani Dachas and is burned, you're allowed to take that dirt and use it. I didn't ask to be burnt as well. No, because the pasuk says that it's called shlala tikva shal tocherechay. Well, the pasuk says you have to gather all the spoils, all the possessions of the Irani Dachas into its main square, the sarafta, and then you burn them. So we learn from that. Now, just like we learned the other day, for example, about the Shachat Vechisa, that when the Torah puts two verbs back to back, it means it has to be one after the other, with no other action in between. So the same way over here, when it says Kikvotz, and then it says Vesaratzka, you gather it, and then you burn it, we learn from that. Mishen Mechotze, Ela Kivitza, it was Sirefa, that means that the din of burning applies only to things which can be gathered and then burnt, and you don't need anything else in between. As opposed to here, the dirt, Shemachosa Tzlisha, Kvitza, or Srefa. Here you'd have to, it's not in between, actually, but here you'd have to do three things. First you'd have to detach it from the rest of the ground. You'd have to dig it up. Then you'd have to gather it. Then you'd have to burn it. So therefore, the Pasuk is implying that you don't have to do that. So therefore, the dirt of the area of the Eir Nidachos remains Mutabana, and therefore, Reb Zeira or Rav Bar Yirmiyah is telling us that you are allowed to use that. In a similar vein, for example, the Gemara talks about Sanhedrin, that let's say, for example, trees that are still growing in the ground, when the Eir Nidachos is destroyed, also don't have to be burned for the same reason, because you first have to uproot them before you can gather them, etc. The Rava, our Rava says, never mind that, you could even use the ashes like we thought originally. Mitzvahs, lav lahonis nitnu, the mitzvahs are not given for hana, meaning, in other words, Hashem gives us a mitzvah, they're not given for hana. As Rashi says, gzeira smelach yaleim, it's a gzeira of the king of Hashem, it's something we have to do, and you can't say that we're receiving any hana, we can't say we're receiving any hana from it. Of course, we get a schar for it from Hashem, but in other words, but that kind of thing, that kind of thing is not considered a hana. So it's not even the dirt, but even the ashes, even though they are indeed also hana, doing the mitzvah is not considered a hana. Well, the Gemara says, Yosef Ravina Rekamala Lahashmaita. Ravina was sitting and saying over the statement of Rava's that you could do Kisi Adam with ashes from an Eir Nidachos. Esre Rav Rechumi L'Ravina, but Rav Rechumi questions Ravina. What about, though, we learn in a Brisa, Shofar Shalavetz Chavim L'Yisabai, a shofar of Avodah Zarah, a shofar that was worshipped as Avodah Zarah, for example, Lo Yisabai, you're not allowed to blow with it on Rosh Hashanah. So Rav Rechumi says, my love, imtaka lo yotza. Now, the implication seems to be that if he did blow with it, he wouldn't be yotza. So you see, in other words, that even though tkiyas shofar is a mitzvah, and we also say on that mitzvah slav lahonis nitnu, if Reuven made a neder not to have any benefit from Shimon, he's still allowed to hear Shimon blow shofar, because that's not considered a hanah. But over here, it sounds like the Braise is implying that you can't use a shofar of Avodah Zarah for that purpose, showing that even though mitzvahs lav lahonis nitnu, nevertheless, it's still also. So it should be the same thing over here. And the answer is, Ravina answers, like, im taka yotza. No, it means he's not supposed to, l'chatchila, because it's disgusting to use something of Avodah Zarah for a mitzvah to honor Hashem. But nevertheless, if he did you yotza because mitzvahs lav lahonis nitnu, and it's not, then it's not also b'hanah, it is also b'hanah, but this isn't considered a hanah. So the Gemara asks, what about though, lulav shall Avodah Zarah chavim lo yitzo, but the Braisa continues, you're not allowed to take a lulav that belonged to Avodah Zarah. So again, my lav im not a lo yotza. So it sounds like again it means, and if you did take such a lulav, then you're not yotza. So again, how does that fit with mitzvahs lav lahonis nitnu? And again, the answer is no. It means loy, not necessarily does it no. It doesn't mean that he's not yotze. He's not so yotze. If the diyevet, he did take such a lulav, and again, the chatzilah, he shouldn't, but the diyevet, he might well be yotze. So they want to ask for a tanya, toka lo yotze, not a lo yotze. On the other hand, though, we have a braisa that clearly says that if he blew shofar with a shofar of Avodah Zarah, then he's not yotze, and that if he took lulav with a lulav of Avodah Zarah, then he's not yotze. Now Tosfos points out that there are possibilities over here. You could distinguish, for example, did the Avodah Zarah belong to a yid versus to a good? An Avodah Zarah that belongs to a yid, you can never be mevatel, as opposed to an Avodah Zarah that belongs to a goy, the goy himself or another goy can be mevatel, that he can declare now from now on this is not being used for Avodah Zarah, and therefore it becomes mutar b'hanah. So you have that distinction. Tosfos points out you also have a distinction even between Avodah Zarah of a Goy itself before Bittul. It's before Bittul was also Bahana. After Bittul was only Mutar Bahana, but nevertheless, again, it's still disgusting to use it for the mitzvah. And then Tosfos goes on with some detail about the ins and outs of these different possibilities. Rishonim point out that another way of looking at it is the Ritva points out in Sefer Rosh Hashanah that Rav Nachumi had thought, and the Brice over here seems to be implying that's a mitzvah above Aveira. That another reason you shouldn't is because you're doing the mitzvah by means of an Aveira, and therefore you shouldn't be doing that. Another way of looking at it would be that maybe in fact if the person is actually doing a mitzvah with it, then you could say in a certain sense, not in the same mitzvah slav mahonas mitzvah, but nevertheless in a certain limited hana, and the fact that now he's yotze the mitzvah, maybe indeed he shouldn't be yotze then with something the Torah doesn't want him to be yotze in a way like that. So the answer is Omer Rav Ashi. However, Rav Ashi says, Hochi Hashta, how are you thinking to compare the two cases of Lulav and Shofar, where yes, Spreiser says you're not Yotze with one of Avodah Zarah, versus over here, we're talking about the ashes of an Irani Dachas, which even though they're also Bahana, it's a different situation, says Rav Ashi. Meaning, in other words, again, you don't have to say, as Tosfos is saying, the difference between whether they belong to a Yid or a Goy, you don't have to say before Bittul or after Bittul. Rav Ashi points out, even with Shofar and Lulav, you have a very good reason why not to use ones of Avodah Zarah. Shi'urah b'chosem, in those cases, shi'urah b'hinan, we require a minimum shi'ur. A Shofar has to have a minimum size, at least a tefach. A Lulav has to have a minimum size, at least 4 tefachim. And we have a rule of Avodah Zarah. Now, when it comes to Avodah Zarah, we have a rule called kolo oimet listris kisorof dom. Rashi points out, we have a rule in other places in Shach, when something is meant to be burnt, then to a certain extent in Halacha, it's considered as though it was already burnt. We learned that in Menachos, for example. So now it can be considered, in a sense, as though that shofar, that bullet, already was burnt, as being Osabana. Again, if it belonged to a Yid, as Tosfos says, where there it's always forever Osabana, or if it belonged to a Goy, and you haven't been Mavakar like that. So then it can be considered as though it's already burnt, and therefore, therefore, in effect, its size has already been cut down. In other words, it can be considered as though it's already been turned into ashes. And as ashes, it wouldn't be valid as a shofar, and as ashes, it wouldn't be valid as a lulav. So you can't be yotze. As opposed to Hocha, but over here, Rav Ashi points out, Tolad Bachatas, Malo the Kisri. You want to say it's considered as though it's broken up into tiny fragments? Very well. The more it's broken up into tiny fragments, the better it is. You see, Adam, like we learned yesterday about coarse sand versus fine sand. In other words, Katosi Mifta Shiore would not be a reason to not do Kisya Dab, okay? The only one would be the Hana, and fine, Mitzvah Slav Bahonis Nitnu, and therefore you don't have that issue. The Mephoshim point out that Kisya Adam, you also need a certain minimum amount in the sense you need enough to cover the blood. So one way of looking at it is that in fact, yeah, but the difference is it a substance or not? Again, you know, when it comes to a shofar, when it comes to a lulav and other areas in halacha, where we talk about this idea of kafusi mechnes yure, then it means the thing itself is considered as though it's reduced to fragments. And therefore you don't have any fragment that's large enough for the purpose. As opposed to over here, you can say, and the point is, it's not so much you need a certain minimum amount of dirt. What it is you need the blood needs to be covered by dirt. If you only have a tiny bit of blood, then you need a tiny bit of dirt, and therefore it doesn't matter what shear there is. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is that if you destroy it, to go for the mitzvah, then it means the raven gives us an explanation. Then it means that you can't use it for the mitzvah. But over here, again, there's no such thing as destroying. The more you grind up these ashes or whatever, the better they are for the mitzvah, and therefore we don't have a problem. Adam aloch kisi Adam. Starting now the seventh year, which is called Dinan Moshe, and the subject of it is, the subject of the first half of it is the dinim of the Dinan Moshe, which is Osir, and then later on, as we go through the parak, we're going to talk about other dinim of other parts of the animal that are also Chelev and other such things. So we know the Torah tells us that Yaakov fought with the Malach. In most opinions, it was Esav's Malach, and the Malach injured him in his hip. And then Yaakov was limping for a while, and therefore there's the mitzvah. How came the Yisrael to make Yisrael's Gid HaNosha? Therefore, Jewish people do not eat the Gid HaNosha. Nosha really means that it jumped away, because in other words, it got dislocated. Asher HaKaf HaYorech, which is on the spoon of the thigh, Ada Yenazeh. What is the spoon of the thigh is, so you have an animal's thigh, a person's also for that matter, has a muscle on it, has a rounded muscle on the upper bone of it. You have your thigh bone, which is connected to your hip bone. And in a person, as like we talked about before in the fourth parak, in a person, you have two major segments of the leg. You have the thigh, and then you have the shin. In an animal, you have three, because an animal has a third segment corresponding approximately to our foot, and then the animal walks on its tiptoes. But in any case, the upper bone, the thigh bone, is basically the same in a person and an animal. So now you have on that bone, there's a muscle, and then in medical ease, it's called the quadriceps femoris muscle, which has a rounded shape to it, and that's the calf hyoris, that's the spoon of the thigh. And now, so you have the eudaimonia, the sciatic nerve, runs along that, and then that's what's also to eat. So our parak is going to deal with the details of that mitzvah. There are various explanations that Rishonim and give of reasons behind the mitzvah, and the pasuk itself says to remember what happened with Yaakov, but why Yaakov do we have to remember it that way? So the Ramban gives an explanation based on a medrash that even though Yaakov came out victorious from that fight, he still was injured and had to limp for a while, and that represents how there's going to be times in Jewish history when the goyim are unfortunately able to overpower us for a period of time. The medrash mentions in that connection the shmab of the times of Adrianus, of Hadrian, which killed many, many Jews and outlawed Yiddishkeit. Closer to our times, we have many examples of that in Jewish history, all the way down to and including the Holocaust. So therefore, so the Gid HaNosha reminds us of that no matter what, we're still going to come out of it on the other side alive and injured, but nevertheless still alive, just like Yaakov Avinu did. The Zohar, in fact, and says that we know the Shasag Gidim, the 365 Gidim in the body, and those correspond to the 365 days a year. So the Zohar says the Gid HaNosha particularly corresponds to Tisha B'Av, the day on which more than any other day, the Goyim were in fact able to temporarily overpower us. Different other points about the symbolism of the Gid HaNosha that are brought in different Sfarim. Shamshon of Fall Hirsch has an interesting idea of it. He says the idea is that it should remind us that we can't stand on our own power. The only thing that keeps us standing and going is Hashem helping us, just like it was with Yaakov. The Rebbe has an explanation in a sicha in Chelek Lamed that why particularly, I mean, on the one hand, we're memorializing specifically this event in Yaakov's life where he was saved for all time. Unlike, for example, we don't have any mitzvah, let's say, to memorialize that Abraham was thrown into the furnace and saved from it, or Yitzchak Nakeda, for sure, but let's say we don't have any specific mitzvah to remember that Abraham was thrown into the furnace and saved from it. Why Dafka? But we have a mitzvah over here of Gid HaNosha in connection with Yaakov being saved, and at that, we're doing it specifically, it's so specific that it refers to the particular nerve of Yaakov that was injured. And then it develops the idea over there that this symbolizes the whole concept of detail, the Shkoha Pratis, that every single detail is significant, and therefore here it's after that one little detail that's significant and that drives the mitzvah, and specifically by Yaakov, because out of all of the others, we have the closest connection to him. We're descended, only Jewish people descend from him, as opposed to Avraham and Yitzchak, who have other nations descend from them, and so on and so forth, and therefore the symbolism is in that. So now our perek is going to deal with the details. Again, the first half of the perek is going to deal with the details of the mitzvah of Gidan Nasha. We're also going to discuss a piece of Agadah, discussing in some detail that whole story of Yaakov fighting with the Malach and various other related topics. And then further on in the perek, we're going to talk about other things in the body of an animal that has to be removed before you can eat it, such as various pieces of chalev and blood vessels and whatnot. So the Mishnah starts, Gidan Nosha, Noyeg Ben Ba'oretz Ben L'Chutzlaretz. The din of Gidan Nosha applies both in Eretz Yisrael and outside Eretz Yisrael. Now, there's not really much of a chiddush in that, but it's Chovas HaGuf, it's something that applies to a yid on a personal level, and such mitzvahs apply anywhere in the world. It's not really, but because we have, as we've learned before, we have other prokim and our masechta that do have to distinguish between mitzvahs that apply in Eretz Yisrael versus outside of it, and you have a similar formula at the beginning of each one of them, so therefore it uses the same formula throughout, and it mentions Ba'aretz of HaChutzlaretz. Bifnei HaBayis, the Shalom Bifnei HaBayis, it applies whether the Beis HaMikdash is standing or not. Again, there's not necessarily a chiddush in that, but again, it's part of that formula. The cholin of a mukdashin, it applies both to cholin animals and to kodshin animals. So unlike, for example, Kisi Adam, the previous perek, that we said does not apply to mukdashin, here the dinner that you're not allowed to eat, the gidan nasha, does apply to kodshin as well. As we will see in the Gemara, does that apply even to kodshin that are completely burnt, such as the oila? We're going to discuss that tomorrow, Reza Hashem. Next, continues the Mishnah. The noyig the behemo v'chaya, it applies whether to domestic animals and wild ones. Again, unlike we learned before about kisi adam, for example, that it applies only to wild animals. The yerach sheyamin or the yerach shosmoil, it applies equally to the right thigh and to the left thigh. Unlike we're going to learn later on in the perek that Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. The ainu noyig ba'oif, however, it does not apply to a bird, because it doesn't have that spoon-shaped thing. If you look at a chicken thigh, you buy a chicken thigh in the store, the thigh is kind of broad and flat. It doesn't have that rounded shape. You have the drumstick in the chicken, the lower leg, has that rounded muscle, but they already, that's way below the yerech, that's way below the thigh, that's the lower bone of the chicken's leg. And therefore, that's not important for our purposes. But with an animal, and with a person, it's the upper bone, it's the thigh bone that has that calf, that has that rounded quadriceps muscle, and therefore, it's to that that Gidan Nosha applies. The Mishnah continues, V'noyeg B'shlil, also the issue of Gidan Nosha applies to an unborn baby that we talked about, Ben Pekur, that we learned about in previous Perakim, when you shecht an animal and find a baby inside, and find a baby alive inside the womb, then you're not allowed to eat its Gidan Nosha either. As we will learn the details about that later on in the poem. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, in a noyeg b'shlil, Rabbi Yehuda says it does not apply to this unborn baby. The chel by mutter, and furthermore, the chelav of that unborn baby would be mutter, which again we'll talk about that more later on in the panel. Speaking of chelav, first of all, now, so the Mishnah continues, ve'ena tabochin nem monen al gidan nosha. Now, a butcher is not believed about the gidan nosha to say that I took it out. You have to check for it yourself. Give it a mayor, so says your mayor, because the gidan nosha, is the sciatic nerve, and we're going to go through the perek over here, we're going to talk about that it may also include different other nerves that branch out or that run parallel to it, or those have a lot of branches. Sciatic nerve especially has a lot of branches that innervate all the muscles of the leg. And you have to take out all the detailed branchings of it, and it's very, very hard to do. So therefore, we don't believe a butcher who sells you a piece of meat from that part of the animal to say, I took out the gidan nosha, because it's from that tremendous tircha to go in and get all those little bits. And therefore, we're concerned that he didn't do it. So you have to check it yourself. In fact, because of that, because it's so difficult to do, that kind of thing, it's called nikurim, it's called shaydering in Yiddish, in general, nowadays, in many places in the world, they don't even do it. They just sell the back half of the animal, which contains the gidan nosha and these various things, the chalev and so forth, some of which are very difficult to remove. Nowadays, in most countries, they just sell that whole back half to goyim as non-kosher meat. So there are some places in the world where they have a shortage of meat, and there they'll, I think particularly in Eretz Yisrael, and there they'll go through the hassle of, in fact, doing that careful nifur and removing all of that. And you have, there are svarim written in the last several hundred years, various svarim on this topic of nikur, explaining in practice what you have to do, what exactly you have to slice and what you have to remove, but it's a very, very difficult, painstaking process. It's the reason why the derech klal, you won't find kosher cuts of meat from the back half of the animal. You don't really, you don't tend to find kosher T-bone steaks or rump roasts or sirloins or various other cuts from like that because of this whole business of nipper being very difficult. Anyway, so the mayor says because of that, therefore, you can't trust the butcher to say that he actually removed them. But my Nachum said, no, Nehman and Olav, we do believe them to say that the Gid and Nasha has been removed. Ba'ala Chelev, and we also believe them to say that they removed the Chelev, and you don't have to check for it. Now, as the Ritzvah points out, we're going to have later on in the Sefer, Reb Meir is the one who holds, they have to dig out and get every single branching of the Gid and Nasha. Reb Yehuda disagrees with that later on in the Perek, therefore he says, there's no reason you can't trust him with the Gid and Nasha, you don't have to remove the whole thing anymore. Okay. So the Gemara starts off. Mukdoshim Pshita. Isn't it obvious that Gidanosha applies to Kodshim as well? Meaning, in other words, Tosfa says, so far, I mean, all the other things as well, but Oretz of a Chutzar, Bifnei Abayis, Bifnei Abayis, all those are Pshita as well. But we have to find at least one thing where there seems to be some kind of Chidush. The Chidush seems to be that it's mentioned and it applies to Mukdoshim. So, and with that, then it gives the whole list just like it does in the other Prokim and Arma Sefer. So the question is then, what's the Chidush with that either? Are you going to think that because you were makdish the animals of korban, therefore the issue of din anotcha should go away? Now you might answer to say that you have as we go through the perek, we're going to learn a number of times that you have a machlokas. Does the din anotcha itself and other gidim that are and other gidim, do they have a flavor? Are they considered like meat and they have an actual detectable flavor? So therefore, when the Torah tells us you're not allowed to eat meat of a non-kosher animal, for example, or of a trefa or whatever, that automatically it includes the gid, or would we say the gid is actually just like wood? It doesn't really have a taste to it. And nevertheless, the Torah is saying that's also. So now, b'chitema, so you might answer, yesh b'gidim menoisim tam, maybe the gidim themselves are considered to have an actual individual flavor, and therefore, for example, if you put meat with the gid anosha in it, then you're going to need gidol b'shishim, because the flavor of the gid anosha will get absorbed into the meat. And then you would say, v'osti isum mukdoshin, v'chayla isu gid. And then you would say like this, as it is, the gid anosha was also and a person who eats it gachmalchus. But now the isu of kodshin is able to be chal on top of that, because now you have, when he eats, if he eats that gid anosha, then he's doing two things wrong. He's eating gid anosha, and he's eating something of kodshin, which he's not allowed to have anah from. And in that case, there would be a double chinuch in it, Rashi points out. Number one, that the Tana holds yesh beginim and oisim tam. And number two, that isu chalal isu. And the point is, again, as opposed to, we're going to learn later on in the Perek, there's an opinion that the gid does not really have a flavor. So therefore, so you could argue that's the chiddush of our Mishnah. The question though is, Hai Mukdoshin, no, you give me Borilai. If that were the case, if that were the chiddush of the Mishnah, then it should say the other way around. The din of a hekdish also applies to the gid anotha. In other words, the gid anotha itself is already independently answer. And then on top of that comes the issur of Mukdoshin, and now if a person answers gid anotha from Kodshin, then it's going to be kind of double malchus for it. So no, that can't be the chiddush. That can't be the chiddush of the Mishnah. Rather we have to say Kosover, Tana of our Mishnah holds in the gid in the Noisim Tam. The gid itself is not considered to be something that gives a flavor. It's considered like just a piece of wood that doesn't exude a flavor into anything else. So all he's saying is over Mukdoshin. So he's saying when it comes to Hekdish, Isu, gid ikka, isu mukdoshan lechay. There isn't isu to eat gid anosha, because even if it doesn't have a taste, you have it less. Zeris akhasi. That is also, but there's no isu of kodshim. In other words, if a person eats the gid anosha, you can't say that he was over also on the isu of eating kodshim when he wasn't supposed to, because that's not really considered eating. As far as the din of gid anosha is considered eating, because they especially, the Torah tells us the gid anosha is also. But other than that, it's not really considered food. It's not considered menosim tam, and therefore the chiddush would be that when the person eats it, he's only chayav for gid anosha, he's not also chayav for kodesh. So that would be, in other words, so the chiddush of the Mishnah would be when it says applies the mukdoshin, means that's the only issur that when a person eats a gid anosha from the mukdoshin, that's the only issur that is over is the issur of gid and not the issur of mukdoshin. So the Gemara says the sabatani didan ain the gidim nice and tam. So you're telling me the Tana of our Mishnah holds that gidim do not have a flavor, do not exude a flavor. Well, it's not. We learn later on in our Perek, Yerech Shenisvashah B'Gidan Nosha, a thigh of an animal that was cooked with the Gidan Nosha still inside it. Im Yesh B'Noisin Tam. So now, if it has Noisin Tam, if there's little enough of the Yerech, of the thigh itself, that the Gidan Nosha is actually be able to give it a flavor. Namely, in other words, the Mishnah will explain there exactly how to evaluate it. How raise your asura, and the whole thigh is also. So we see, in other words, that you have the concept of bitul b'shishin, and then the idea behind bitul b'shishin is that when you have one less than 1/60th, and you don't have a detectable flavor. But here, the Mishnah says that if you don't have enough meat on the yerech in order to be mevatel the gidan nosheh, in that way, then the whole yerech is going to be also. So we assume the Tana of that Mishnah is the same as the Tana of our Mishnah, and that means he holds the Gid does exude a flavor into the meat. So the Gemara says no. So that doesn't really work then to say that the Tana holds, that the whole Tana holds in the Gid Menos and Tam. And again, if it meant Yesh the Gid Menos and Tam, and the Chiddush is that the Issu of Mukdachin is Chakal on top of it, then the Mishnah isn't phrased correctly. Then it should say that, Mukdachin Noig the Gid. Tosfos also discusses, can't be that the Chiddush is not, that the Issu is not, that the Issu of Mukdashin is not Chal on Issu Gid, because on Mishnah goes, because on Mishnah we're saying is like Reb Meir, but on Mishnah is, and on Mishnah is like Reb Meir, who holds the concept that it can apply to Issu, that Issu Chal of Issu applies. But anyway, Tosfos points out that it's not going to be that you have other Mishnayas, other Sam Mishnayas that say Issu Chal of Issu, and we're not going to assume that on Mishnah is going against all of that. So rather we need a different answer. Rather, here we're talking about when we say that Gidan Nosha applies to Mokdashin, we mean the baby of a Kodshim animal. So you have a Shlomim, for example, a Shlomim was pregnant, and then gave birth. Or not gave birth, but rather you shefted the mother animal and you found, gave birth. So first of all, the Tana of our Mishnah holds that is that Gidan Nosha does also apply to a baby found alive in the womb. But for Saba, furthermore, he also holds Vladis Kodshim and they even hang Kodosh. The baby of Kodshim becomes Kodosh while it's still in the womb. In other words, you shouldn't think that it's Machloikas in other places. In Shas, we touched on it earlier in our Masechta. At what point does the baby of a Kodshim animal become Kodosh? Is it when it's born, or is it even when it's formed in the womb? The Tana of our Mishnah would hold even while it's forming in the womb, it's already considered Kodosh, and therefore the Issu Gid, the Issu Mokdashim, Bahadi Adari, Ka'asi. So therefore the Issu of the Gid Anasha and the Issu of Kodshim come about at the same time, because as soon as the baby starts forming, you have the Gid, and at the same time you also have the baby is also to eat, the baby is also to have anah from, not as a korban. So therefore, so the two isurim come together, the two isurim come simultaneously, and therefore the Mishnah is telling us that a person will be chayav for both of them. If now he eats the Gid anasha of that shlil, then he is going to be chayav double. Then he is going to be chayav double malchus for that. Tosfos discusses, though, that actually, wait a minute, it doesn't become also until, that, as we're going to learn later on in the parak, only until the pregnancy, and only until the pregnancy is full term, 9 months. So the issue doesn't apply to that, but then Tosfos says that no, it means, in other words, that yeah, if it's less than that, and the mother is shechted, then the baby becomes mutter. But up until that point, meanwhile, the issue of the Gid continues to apply, and then Tosfos goes on to discuss that point in a little more detail, why would we say that the two Isurim come at the same time? But the Gemara says, "Mi matzis mukmis lo b'shlil." How could you say the Mishnah is talking about a shlil? Avamid katani sefer no b'shlil. The Mishnah continues and says that it applies to a shlil. Miklal the reisha lo b'shlil askinah. So therefore, that implies that the reisha is not talking about a shlil. And the answer is fine. Maybe the Mishnah is telling us that you should know this point, that Gid Anosha Noig B'Mukdashin, which now we're saying refers specifically to a shlil, you should know it's not universally agreed to. Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. So in other words, the Mishnah will be telling us that it applies to Mukdashin, namely to a shlil, an unborn baby of Mukdashin. But you should know, that's according to the Tanakhama, you should know Noig B'Shlil, according to the Tanakhama, but Rabbi Yehuda disagrees. Okay. So, but we'll continue tomorrow and see. The assumption is that Bahrami Hadori policy, the issue of the Gidan Noshe, and the issue of the baby itself as water scorching, come at the same time. So we'll continue tomorrow, Be'ez Hashem, and the Gemara is going to take up that point and see whether in fact that's the case.